Whose rights, which rights? Global contestations of women's and gender rights.
One topic is all over the news since the beginning of 2020, the COVID-19 crisis. The global approach to societal, economic, and social consequences varies widely. More women are again caring for children at home. Underpaid professions such as nursing seemingly moved into political spotlight, more domestic violence. Gender inequality seems more likely to be exacerbated by the COVID-19 crisis. An interdisciplinary group has been conducting research at the Center for Interdisciplinary Research, Bielefeld University, since October 2020 on the topic of global contestations of women's and gender rights. And that's why we thought a podcast would be the perfect place to bring the research results to anyone who's interested. My name is Katharina Usling. I'm a moderator at Campus Ready Herz 87.9, and I'm really glad to host this podcast episode. So today we will talk about the COVID-19 crisis and social reproduction. For this talk, I welcome Martina Sproll, professor for social sciences at the Berlin School of Economics and Law, and Anja Plomin, assistant professor at the Department of Gender Studies, London School of Economics and Political Science. So thank you very much for being here today with me. And as in the other episodes, I would like to start with a short introduction round by yourself. Maybe Martina, you can start and tell us about your research focus and especially in this project.
Thank you very much, Katharina, for having me and us here at your radio and for this podcast. Yeah, my name is Martina Sproll, and you already introduced me. I'm a professor of social sciences at the Berlin School of Economics and Law. And at the research group on global contestations of women's and gender rights, together with Anja Plomin and Alexandra Scheele, we have been working especially on the question of gender division of labor, on the question of social reproduction. And as the pandemic is, the issue which has been dominating our lives and is very much linked to this question of social reproduction in our work, we have also been focusing very much on this question of how social reproduction at the crisis of social reproduction is linked to what is happening in this pandemic, right? And so gender inequalities, but also other dimensions of inequalities, intersectional inequalities, as we call that. Gender plus other dimensions of power and inequalities such as class and race and ethnicity and maybe also other factors or dimensions such as age or sexual orientation is something we include and try to consider when talking about gender inequalities.
Thank you very much. Anja Plomin, maybe you can also tell us what is your field of research and especially in the research group Global Contestations of Women's and Gender Rights.
Thank you, Katharina, very much. Yes, I'm Anja Plomin and I am an associate professor at the Gender Studies Department at the London School of Economics. And there I both teach as well as do research that most comfortably sits within the genre of feminist political economy. And to this project with Martina and Alexandra, I brought some of the background and expertise in social reproduction from a transnational perspective, focused on the European context at the EU, but also beyond the EU in Europe. Quite a lot of my work is to do with migration and social reproduction, and some of the changes over the last years that we have seen in the context of Europe when it comes to sectors of production, but also in terms of domestic sectors and changes at the state level, have fed into how we were thinking about what COVID-19, the pandemic, and policy responses to it are shaping in terms of how our social life, whether it's becoming more or less unequal, comes out of this process. And so when we started talking with Martina and Alexandra about what interests us, we were in the middle of this pandemic that has really touched everyone, everywhere, very deeply. But while it was a shared experience for all of us, it was not common in the sense of how badly we were affected, or actually also how well some people have benefited from the pandemic. And so we were curious to investigate it a little bit more deeply.
Yeah, thank you very much for your self-introduction. So you're both doing research on social reproduction as kind of a basic structure for social inequality, as I understood, and how gender is linked with social economic life and also what's going on since the beginning of 2020 and how it affected all of us. Maybe we can just take a step back and first explain to the listeners what social reproduction means. Martina, can you start?
Yes, of course. But maybe I would, before that, add one sentence to what Anya said, because she already pointed to the perspective that we try to adopt, which is not a German one, but is a transnational one. So this was something I think which was very much guiding our research and also reflects, our research we've been doing before and still are doing. So this is also a field I'm coming from. I have been doing a lot of research on global value chains and sustainability and inequalities along global value chains. And so we could see that also the pandemic, of course, is affecting people in a different way if we look with that transnational lens. And so we try to include that also. And this, of course, also applies to the whole topic and the whole field of social reproduction, which is in general a very basic topic or question if we look into capitalist economies and capitalist societies. Because since the beginning of industrialization, we have a dual structure in our societies. Yeah? We have a divide between the sphere of production and the sphere of reproduction. And this divide is a very basic structure, which at the same time is gendered. The sphere of production, which at the same time belongs to the public sphere, has a male connotation. Yeah? And we have the field of social reproduction, which at the same time is also often linked to the private sphere. And this is the sphere where mostly women are doing this social reproductive work, and they are mostly doing it without remuneration, that is, without being paid. And so this is a very basic structure in our societies, which generates asymmetric gender structures and thus gender inequality. Yeah? So because this creates unequal recognition and reputation, unequal payment and thus dependencies, financial economic dependencies, well, the adscription of gender roles and so on and so on.
Yeah, with that, you already answered my next question as well, which would have been, how is it linked to inequalities regarding gender? And yeah, as I understood you, it's kind of because we have this dual structure in our society. But because you focused on the transnational perspective and make that very clear to Anya, maybe you can also explain to us how it depends on something like race, ethnicity, religion, and how important an intersectional, maybe feminist research approach to this topic is.
I think I'll start from that point, which Martina elaborated on, is this divide between the public and the private. And while this divide has been something that has been unequally conceived and constructed, in real life, these divides are not so clear and not so neat. So what happens that these spheres, while divided and the public sphere is being privileged and supported, they are at the same time very closely linked and interconnected, where we can really not have the public sphere without having the private sphere that underpins it. And that's that privileging of the public or the masculine model of life or biography contrast with that which gives cultural significance, but not a proper support or remuneration to the feminine sort of sphere of the caring labor, for example. And so with social reproduction, the way we see it is an analytical framework to help us connect these two seemingly separate spheres into one frame that shows the interdependencies between them. And so social reproduction is the kind of work that enables societies to reproduce again through the daily work, through the intergenerational renewal, through producing people, but also through producing people in ways that they are socially brought up, that they are educated, that they are cared for. And these different elements of social reproduction, or these different activities, have been done through households, have been done through the support of markets, because people require, let's say, income and wages to support their activities and survive. And they have been done through the public sphere as well, through policies and services and benefits that support, let's say, the care system or the education system or people in retirement. And so there is this privileging on the one hand of the market and the public sphere, and not so much the domestic sphere, yet they are interconnected. And there's a certain social valuing to what kind of activities get remunerated. And they are associated with the gender division of labor. And they are also associated with position of people in society that have other dimensions. So it's a question of class. It's a question of migration status. It's a question of sexuality. It's a question of ability or disability. Because what gets resourced is that public sphere. Employment is being privileged over non-employment. And these intersectional inequalities play very much with people's positions in society and what gets resourced.
So I think this is a very important point, and it's really amazing. Well, she was talking about this nexus between the two spheres, right, of production and reproduction. And this is really a necessary link, because our societies would not survive. They would not be able to reproduce themselves without the sphere of reproduction. But this is usually neglected. And this is really amazing that in most economic theories, well, not looking, of course, at the feminist critique at it, but the mainstream economic theories, they don't include all the productive work which is being done unpaidly in the reproductive sphere. You know? They don't even calculate it for their GDPs. So this is really amazing that there has been so much disconsideration of this very fundamental, part of the reproduction of the whole society. Yeah, so this is something where feminist critique came in saying, okay, you have been neglecting an elemental part of it, and we have to include that, because otherwise we wouldn't understand how economies and societies function, how they reproduce themselves, and we would not be able to see the dynamics of inequalities linked to it, just like Anya explained us.
Yeah, and just to make it clear, we are not talking about perspective just or how it's just in Germany, but a global perspective here. And we talked in other episode as well about the global south and the global north. And I want to elaborate on that. And to Anya, the question, in which countries can you see what you both explained to us, which we can call the crisis of social reproduction, maybe? We can see this particularly strongly, and maybe also what role Germany plays as an EU country in this.
Okay, so the crisis of social reproduction is really a global phenomenon, and that's our claim. That and it's not just our claim, but the crisis of social reproduction is something that has been taking place over the last few decades, gradually in different places, in different ways. So while it is, we see it transnationally, it manifests itself differently in the different local contexts. So for example, in certain European countries, whether it's Germany or the UK or Poland or Ukraine, you would have the crisis of social reproduction manifest itself by withdrawing of state services and benefits that have supported and were built up through the idea of the welfare state. And decades of either austerity measures or commodification or marketization in spheres that support social reproduction provide societies with the difficulties of how do we fill that gap in what has been or is being weakened or taken away, or what is being provided on a different logic, like a market logic. In other countries in which Martina can add, because it is also her area of research and specialism, we would have a different dynamic where the more global politics would come in also over several decades, where state policies and governments were encouraged to actually make cuts within their provisions because of the structural adjustment policies that they had to implement to respond to the demands like from the institutions like the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank, which helped them through a crisis, but governments would have to respond by making cuts and savings. And these typically affected those areas of life. So there is a geopolitical dimension to it as well. What's happening within Europe, but also what's happening between the countries of the global north and the global south.
So Anya has been pointing to structural asymmetries also in this world. And this is, I think, first of all, very basic starting point to understand that in capitalist economies, and if you look into that from a global perspective, we have global asymmetries. And these go back to colonialism and the colonial legacies, which we can see and feel still today. And so this is, of course, relationships which are based on exploitation and regional inequalities. And so, of course, we have different dynamics in these different regions. And we could say that in most countries of the global south, due to these structures, of course, there's less resources for the building of welfare states and for the provisioning of benefits from the state, cash transfer, and so on, infrastructure in terms of healthcare, in terms of social security systems, and so on. Yeah, we could see this difference between countries such as Germany in the global north and most countries in the global south. This does not mean that there wouldn't have been built welfare states in the global south. Now, this is, of course, not true. And there have been quite well developed welfare states also in the global south and very early in history also, in some countries earlier than in Europe even. Yeah. What Anya has been saying, I think, is very much linked to an understanding of capitalism as a dynamics of crisis. Crises are inscribed into capitalist economies. And so we have an up and down of not just economic cycles, but really crisis dynamics. And this, of course, creates sort of a necessity for capital to expand. Yeah? So the growth dynamics is something which is very important to understand. And this has been linked, if we look into the crisis of Fordism, so the mode lot of accumulation we could see, well, in Europe after World War II, and which then already in the 60s and then in the 70s at the latest came into a deep crisis. And so the dynamics was, well, to move out of a mode of accumulation, which was quite linked to a certain mode of welfare also for workers, a high level of inclusion, collective norms, and so on, quite a high degree of participation of workers, the trade unions as part of industrial relations systems and so on, being important negotiation partners. And so this mode of accumulation was also linked to a certain gender division of labor, yeah, which then started to dissolve a little bit by the increasing inclusion of women into the labor force. So not just as unpaid workers at home in the domestic spheres, but as paid laborers in formal labor markets. And they all, always have been working, of course, also in informal labor markets. Okay, but then we had this crisis dynamics, and we had a neoliberal restructuring of economies. And so this meant that the global markets were restructuring in a way of liberalization and deregulation, so the creation of a global financial market and so on. And this is the context where the structural adjustment programs come in, Anya has been talking about. This, of course, did not only happen in the global south. We had all this retrenchment of welfare states everywhere in the world. Yeah? So this high development of welfare states was being pushed down. And so this happened very extremely in many countries in the global south and also in the global north. And this initiated a phase where we have a new degree of precarious labor, of vulnerable labor force. And we can see everywhere that there's a difference regarding gender, because the big majority, this is absolutely not exclusive female, but a majority of these, the most vulnerable and the most precarious workers in this world are women. And they are at the same time belonging to lower social classes, and many of them are migrants, or they have a specific status regarding their race or ethnicity, which makes them more vulnerable and exposed to discrimination and so on. And so this is something which increased incredibly in this world. Okay, and this, of course, at the same time, it meant a sort of land grabbing. Yeah? This expansion of capital means a wave of commodification, also in countries of the global south, which has not been there before to that degree. Yeah? And so this is an increasing inclusion of social fields, for example, families with a subsistence economy, yeah? With a highly self-reliant form of producing and reproducing themselves. And so these parts of societies are increasingly being commodified and integrated in these global production systems and so on. And so we see that everywhere, due to this neoliberal restructuring, the mix between family, state, and the market is changing everywhere. The state and also the family maybe had a stronger role in this Fordist era, and we now have a stronger focus on the market. And so this goes along with this retrenchment. And here we can, of course, see along these lines that the asymmetries I've been talking about before between global north and south, based on colonial legacies and so on, and these asymmetries and exploitative structures is being reinforced and reproduced again.
Yes. So if I could add to what Martina was just saying, is that we've had decades of that process where there has been some kind of a crisis and some kind of a response to it. And COVID-19 and the pandemic is another instance of an opportunity to realign for the governments because there has been a huge crisis. So we were curious to see to what extent state governments have learned the lessons from the past in understanding what the crisis can do to society. And we were basing our starting position from that understanding of the interconnection between households, markets, and the state, but also from decades of feminist economics research that has showed that every financial crisis in the past has actually led to a deterioration of the conditions for people in society, and they have been highly unequal and gendered. And so one study, for example, that was based on 68 countries, so they covered the countries of the global north and the global south, has shown that four different areas of life have deteriorated when it comes to gender. One of them was the labor market. Another one was women's participation in formal politics in the parliaments. Another one was education, so university level education. And another deterioration was with maternal health and reproductive life. And the conclusion of these studies was it's not just the crisis itself that causes the damage, but the institutional reshuffling of what's happening within these countries. So when Martina talked about austerity and structural adjustment, and it being the case not just in the global south, but also in European countries, we've had a situation where Greece in the recent countries was really quite hit hard by the demands of financial institutions of making a certain realignment. And because households, markets, and the public sphere, the services, are gendered, realigning them again reshuffles what's going on from a gender perspective. And the lessons so far have been that women and different marginalized communities have faced a triple jeopardy. The triple jeopardy has happened because A, what's going on in the household, having to produce more within the household because you may not have the resources to buy them on the market or access them via the state. In terms of the state provisioning, services go down and employment of women, public sector is often a very good employer for women in different, in education, in healthcare, in state administration. That gets cut back. And there is then also the third element is because the market is affecting many people, households have to make up that lack of or falling resources, and therefore women also have to go out to the market in order to facilitate a healthier household budget to survive. And so these questions arose, what's happening with the COVID-19 pandemic hitting the countries everywhere in so many different areas of life, and affecting young and old, men and women, rich and poor, employed and unemployed, retired. So everyone was affected. But the question was, were people affected to the same degree? And another one was, how then do states respond to that huge crisis, and whether they provide more resources into the areas or the people who have been affected the most.
So we now talked about that the crisis of social reproduction is not new, but reinforced by the COVID-19 pandemic, and as well how it's manifested under the conditions of the COVID-19 pandemic. And now I want to take a kind of a look into the future, because we see the COVID-19 pandemic is not over yet. We see that in Germany since a few weeks that it's worsen again, and that's the worst point since the beginning of the pandemic. And yeah, but if we take a look into the future, we will face other crises like the climate crisis even more. And maybe we can talk about how this could be exacerbated by other crises in the future, And if you can think we can see a similar picture.
So first of all, I would like to say that this crisis of sexual reproduction is already getting to a point where the economic and political elites have become aware of. So it's only a few years ago that, for example, the World Economic Forum declared social inequalities to be one of the main points which have to be addressed, because they, I think, became aware that this explosion of social inequalities, which happened along this dynamics of neoliberal restructuring everywhere in the world, this would becoming harmful for a smooth functioning of economies. And so this already shows, I think, this conflictive and contradictory nexus between these spheres, and that, well, the social reproduction part is really important also from the perspective of capital, because they wouldn't be able to increase productive activities and profit maximization and so on without a lot of backups, which come from the social reproduction part and also from the state. So this is a basic problem where we already have got to a point where this conflict is becoming deeper and deeper, and people having less opportunities to reproduce themselves because the access to land, to water, to well, nature. You have been talking about the climate crisis, and of course the dispossession, the exploitation and destruction of nature is part of this crisis of social reproduction and cannot be underestimated. Okay, and so we can see, although there's an increasing awareness to all these points, I think world over, right, there is very, very little response to it. Yeah. And we could see that also in the corona pandemic. And here it was especially interesting because it became so clear to everybody what are the essential services in a society. And it became equally clear that a big, big part of these really essential services are being provided by women. May it be in the healthcare sector or in other parts of our economies where the shutdown and of course then also well, illness and the need for caring patients also in intensive care units at hospitals and so on became apparent. And we could see that the austerity politics, which included privatization and also, in this course, of course, a commodification also of essential services, and also the cutback of capacities in this part, for example, now turns out to be a big, big problem, yeah, where states have big difficulties to respond to and to maintain a certain level of, at least a basic level of care for their own populations and citizens, you know. And so we can see this, and in the beginning of the pandemic, I think many of us thought the pandemic opens a window. Yeah? It does not only show these necessities and how important it would be to not just give some money to it, but to rebuild infrastructure in order to address all the poverty, the exclusion, the inequalities which have been increasing and exploding in the last decades. And so we could all see that. But in our work, unfortunately, we concluded that there has been extremely much money being pushed, yeah, to many sectors, to many people and so on. But overall, our conclusion is that this money was mainly used to maintain the functioning of economies, but it was not used to really, in a more fundamental way, stabilize, rebuild, expand, infrastructure in the social reproductive sector. And if we look into future crisis, which will definitely come, we are not out of the pandemic. And we can also see, of course, in these inequalities that a vaccination, for example, has been distributed so unequally in the world. So in the global south, we have a very low degree of vaccination in most countries, because these states have, many of them not been able to get access and have the funding for vaccination and organize the campaigns in their populations. This is not true for all countries, yeah, but in general, we see this divide between the global north and south. The United Nations are constantly pointing to this problem and call for a solution, yeah, because, this is a very unilateral politics of trying to solve a problem which is a global one. And so this can't work, of course. Yeah? Okay, but we can see that there is not the movement we think would be necessary in order to take a lesson from the devastating effects of this pandemic, building on the already existing crisis of social reproduction. And this is so urgent to really rethink now and to put this on the agenda and to say, okay, now stop. We all have seen the consequences, and now states have to act in a new way.
So, and would you say in this act the countries have to do now, globalization is more likely a problem or an opportunity, Anya?
I think globalization is what we make of it. I think it's in our hands to do this. Your first question, Katarina, was politically motivated, the question of crisis, climate crisis, which is with us. Martina has pointed to the politics of it as well. We've had countries, we've had institutions. IMF traditionally has been for austerity measures. With this crisis, the International Monetary Fund has said that policymakers were urged to address this new emergency regardless of how much room a country may have in the budget. So you expect some kind of a transformation in the approach. But instead of the transformation, we've had an adaptation to keep things going. And so they've done whatever they could, but in ways that were not enabling our societal capacity to renew itself and flourish. And so in terms of whether it's a globalization or not, you know, we can have a more politically sensitive relations with other countries and exchange. Globalization per se also has offered opportunities to different people. So it's not necessarily in itself a good or a bad, but the problem lies in the unequal power relations that have now been strengthened through the pandemic and with shifting resources towards the already powerful and rich. And so that is the problem of power and politics, rather than how we actually see ourselves as interconnected societies across the globe.
And maybe now a more personal question, but because you explained that you found out, or that you can see as well, that countries and especially the politic does not act and does not really act different relating to other crises, and that they do not rebuild the fundamental structure of the society and so on. You as a scientist, are you sometimes downcast or kind of disillusionized when you read the news or when you see what's going on?
Thank you for that question, Katarina. On my end, yes, I am depressed when I read the news. And it is so many dimensions of life that are showing that rather than moving ahead with increasing well-being for people and including more and more groups of people in sharing of the resources, that is depressing because it's not happening. But that doesn't mean that we don't have any scope for maneuver. And all of us have more or less to do or to say in this manner, in how we approach voting, how we approach taxation, how we speak to our neighbors, where we shop, what we eat. So there is an element of agency that we can still exercise over the rather depressing state of affairs. But also the resources are stacked up against us, but pooling those resources also in the past has shown that we are able to build better or build differently with mobilizing and collaborating across divides and finding ways to work with that. So that is also important, not just through professional or academic work, but also through personal work. So I was recently at a march that was in solidarity with the abortion fights taking place in Poland. And that's something that one has to do in order to express a dissatisfaction with the way that policymakers are ruling. This, of course, is difficult because we are caught up in our daily lives in having to work, in having to survive, in having to manage, in having to spend more hours on care that hospitals no longer are able to provide, for example. And so it is a struggle. And I think that's a struggle that societies keep putting on the agenda. And we need to be aware of these struggles and participating in them.
I also strongly believe that we live in societies which are coined by so many contradictions and interest conflicts and so on. So we are looking at different fields of contestations. And I think we can always know throughout the history, and I'm absolutely convinced that this will not stop, that people will always try to fight for their rights. They will go against injustice. And so we can see that in the midst of such crises, we have so spectacular mobilizations, not just women for the right of self-determination about their bodies, so the right to abortion, which Anya mentioned, and which also in countries such as Argentina or in Chile is mobilizing so many women. So this is something all over the world. We have new forms of global campaigns, yeah, talking about, positive aspects of globalization, the Me Too campaign went global. This would not have been possible before the age of globalization and so on. So we have continuous struggles of workers, for example, and we have increasingly participation of women's and women's strikes in this world. This is, I think, very important to know, as we can see, okay, there is contestation and there is struggles and resistance. We see that even in unexpected fields. For example, if I look at the gig workers, nobody thought it would be possible to organize such precarious online workers, for example. And now we can see they build trade unions everywhere. The guerrilla riders in Berlin are about to build a work council. So the company is really fighting hard against it, but they will have some success. And so we can see this is like a constant. Yeah, we can see these struggles, and I think they are important, and they shed a light on the character of contestation. And that was also something very important for our research group, yeah, which carries that in its name. So the contestation, the global contestation of women's and gender rights. And so this is at the same time when we see all this these depressive developments, that there's always some light, I think, when we look that people, they really have their dignity and like an impulse to join collectively and to fight for rights.
Yeah, thank you both for making it so clear what each of us and we as a society have to do and can do. Maybe to as kind of a closing round, to come back as you as a scientist and regarding as well to the research group and contestations as the topic, and the question, what is currently unanswered and what remains to be further investigated in your research fields?
One thing that I am working on right now, thinking about the European context, is how social reproduction works from the perspective of people who are transnational mobile migrants. So we're connecting what's going on at the policy level, at the European sort of EU infrastructure and policy infrastructure, institutional level, and what is happening in different countries where people are moving in order to secure social reproduction of their own households and families and communities, but also those of the richer societies. So there are still some questions to be asked about how can we unwind that process where our livelihood depends on the inequalities that are within society, how richer societies depend on cheaper labor within the countries in which this cheaper labor takes place, and transnational migrant labors. So some questions are about how do we put in place different institutional and solutions and ways of living that eradicate those inequalities on which we have become to rely.
There would be many, many fields. I would just like to highlight one, which I'm interested in, and that is digitization. Digitization is something which affects societies on all levels. And it also is something with platformization and so on of work and labor. We can see that there's a new mode of capitalist accumulation coming up through digital technologies and the way this is used to restructure, for example, global value chains. And I think this is an important point and an important field, because on the one hand, we have seen that the global value chains, how vulnerable this is, and how much we depend on. We could see now in the pandemic through the interruption of global value chains, but then also the dependencies which are created. But now with digital technologies, we can expect that there will be a reshaping of global value chains. And of course, this is not first of all and foremost a technological question, but it is one which will have an effect on many different levels. It will reshape the regional structures. So I think we will have new inclusions and exclusions if we look on a global scale at it. And of course, this always goes along, and that is something I think we try to shed a light on. This also always goes along with inequality dynamics. And these are gendered, and these are interlinked, intersected with other dimensions of global inequalities. And so in this context, this will be one of the questions I will further investigate.
Yeah, thank you both very much for the discussion and for being here today with me. This was today's episode of Whose Rights, Which Rights? Global Contestations of Women's and Gender Rights. I discussed with Martina Spreu, Professor for Social Sciences at the Berlin School of Economics and Law, and Anja Plomin, Associate Professor at the Department of Gender Studies, London School of Economics and Political Science, about social reproduction and how it is linked with social economic life and the COVID-19 pandemic. My name is Katharina Usling, and I say thank you for listening and goodbye.